So, for the purpose of the interview, can you say your name and where you live?
Yep. I'm Norman Gaim. I live in Great Cornard, 166 Bills Road, CO10 0JG. Will that do?
And when were you born?
0202 1938, of course.
Mm-hmm. And then, do you have any memories of the war? I guess that's the first question.
Yeah, because I've spoken about it often. About in, I think that was New Year's Day, 1945, a B-17 American bomber taken off from Waldingfield Aerodrome, which is next door to Sudbury, just 2 or 3 miles, on a bombing raid. And many B-17s were taken off at the time, and this one took off. But the crew soon realised they had an engine problem, and they weren't going to be able to gain height. So they radioed in back to base and said, we're not going to make it. Well, we've got to come back and, you know, do whatever. And the base said, well, you can't come back because all the rest of these planes were taken off. And so essentially he said, well, you're on your own, I suppose. Anyway, whether by luck or not, I don't know. They circled because they... And he couldn't go in any height at all, but I don't know how high he was. He wasn't very high at all, and he knew he wasn't going to make it. And he landed, crash-landed, on a Sharford Meadow, which is a huge expanse of grassland, in Little Cornard. And whether they got there by luck or whether they planned it to some extent, whether he could steer the plane or something, I don't know. But anyway, he landed on this big, huge meadow. And when bearing in mind that the thing was loaded full of bombs and, of course, loaded full of petrol, you know, it was inevitable it was going to go boom and blow up. But amazingly, it didn't. They couldn't really make it out. I mean, it didn't. It landed and it just slid along the grass, eventually stopped. Apparently, the right-hand wing was torn off. It hit a tree or something, and it came to a stop quite near the edge of the meadow, as a matter of fact, and quite near the railway, and quite near a railway crossing keeper's cottage. We should have brought that photo. But there is a photo around showing this plane having crash landed and just sitting there, and the photo is from the left hand side, which is quite complete. It's sort of belly flop, there's no wheels. But anyway, that was I think that was January 1, 1945. And this was early in the morning, well, relatively early in the morning, I'm guessing about 7 or something. And in which case it'd have been dark, I suppose, in January. But Now I distinctly remember that I, at the, how old was I, 7 or nearly 7, well, I think I would have been 7 a month later or something. I was born in 38, work it out. I weren't very old. And we all went down there, and then my brothers, a couple of brothers, and because the local lads, you could imagine. And we got there fairly promptly, I suppose, because there was no police or the Americans were local anyway, and but there's no one there except onlookers like me and many others. And I remember looking into that plane, that B-17 on the ground, looking into the side of the plane, the side you can't see in the photo, the right hand side, I presume it'd be a big hole where the wing was torn off, can't remember of course, but figures, done it. And I remember looking in that plane and looking toward the front of the plane, and there was heaps and heaps of silver paper in rolls. Probably the rolls were about an inch thick and probably 4 or 6 inches in diameter, and many, many rolls of this silver paper, which, because I didn't realise then, it turns out that that's the sort of stuff they used to throw out the plane, many rolls of it, and that used to down like snow sort of thing, and that there to counteract the radar, the enemy radar, you know. And I learned that later, of course. But I distinctly remember seeing all this silver paper. And because there used to be loads of that silver paper about anyway later on, we probably took some of the time, I can't remember. Indeed, there was a local lad, Buster Reed. Was it Buster Reed? He did steal some tools out of this plane, and he got borstal, you know, which is a young person's jail thing. But anyway, with this silver paper, I remember making Christmas paper chains with it later on. Not my invention, of course. I mean, but I remember making the paper chains when we were kids. You know, sort of loops about 6 inches in diameter, I suppose, and blah, 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 blah. And we have a million miles of it, I suppose. There's so much of this paper around. But we put it to use. Not the original use, but... You could say that was a better use, I suppose. Or not, I don't know. Anyway, that's my B-17 story. And the photo I mentioned, you can't see it because this is only... it's funny how the B-17 photo came about, because up till... How many years would that go? Probably 10 or 12, 15 years ago. I had no idea, nor did anyone else locally. No, that was a photo of the plane, you know, on the meadow there, you know, having crash landed. And there's a pub in Great Cornard called the Brook Pub, where the guy who used to keep it, his name was Jay, as it happened. Young lad, he's a nice chap. Anyway, he moved from the Brook, which was a few hundred yards from where the plane crashed. A year or two later, this same guy Jay took over another pub in Boxford, which again is 10 miles from Sudbury, the White Hart at Boxford, and he took that pub over, as it happened. He moved pubs, and one evening he was in the pub, and old boy came in, probably about the age I am now, but this was years ago, and they were chatting, just the two of them. And Jay told him he used to cook the Brook at Little Corner, at Great Cornard. And so this old boy said, "Well, you must know all about the B-17 crash then." And Jay looked aghast somewhat. He had no idea, of course he didn't. He hadn't heard anybody talk about it. And so B-17 crash, and he told him what was going on. He said, "Yeah, I'll bring a photo in tomorrow." And he brought this photo in. And this photo... is pretty clear, isn't it? I mean, it looked like a professionally, what do I know, but it was a good photo of this plane, of the good side, so to speak. And that only came about because this guy changed pubs, and the old boy walked in, and they were just chatting, and he said, "Well, do you know all about, if you kept the Brook at Little Corn, at Great Cornard, you'd know all about the B-17 crash." And I say again, he didn't know. But that's how the photo came about. This bloke, where the bloke got it, I do not know. But that's pretty cool when you think about it, isn't it? You know, and when all this surfaced, you know, that brought back. Well, I can remember what I was on about the plane and looking into the plane. Of course, I've always known because I did it originally. But it's not one of those memories that's sort of been configured by your imagination over the years. I distinctly remember, you know, almost as if that was yesterday. You know, but it's a big thing when you think about it. You don't come across many B-17s crashed in, especially with the right wing torn off. Anyway, that's that bit. Adam, what now, boy?
Well, you did mention that you might have taken some as a souvenir, and when we spoke to Peter, he mentioned that he actually ended up taking a spanner, so I was going to ask him.
Well, it's funny, I only learned that the other day when we were talking to Gerald, Peter's brother, Gerald, and he said that, we relating the tale, he knew about Buster Reed and nicked this stuff, but I didn't, I'm not really surprised. I mean, I wouldn't have done that, of course. Probably because they'd had it before I had. But I did have some of the silver paper, or did I? I can't remember. But yeah, I only learned that just the other day.
And when we were talking to Peter as well, he briefly mentioned that he remembers some of the bombs that had gone off in the farmland nearby, and there was actually a bombshell next to Gerald's house.
I certainly don't know anything about that. I think Gerald mentioned that just the other day, just recently. But
so let's see if
I don't remember any... Well, obviously there was bomb damage around, but I don't recall seeing... I don't recall seeing any bomb damage myself at all. Although that wasn't bomb damage. Where we lived in Great Cornard, just up the road from where the B-17 crashed, but in Great Cornard, during the war, it was just a farmer's field, of course, but that was good sand and gravel. They'd done tests and stuff, and they excavated that whole field, two or three fields, in fact, behind where we lived, just up the road from the Brook pubs that happened. And I remember distinctly that, well, of course, I used to play over there. They used to dig the gravel out, and there was many international trucks, lorries, sand lorries, you know, which are American. They must have been brought over, well, obviously, during the war, I suppose, and the guys used to... get loaded, they'd dig it all the sand out with excavators of the day, and take a tour of the various aerodromes. This would have been 44, 45, I suppose, 43, 44. And they used to go to the, oh no, it's, and we used to ask the lorry drivers, where are you going? He'd say, going to Hepworth. There's, Hepworth is a village in the middle of Suffolk somewhere, and there was a big aerodrome there, and I can't think of another, but there was various places within, 20, 30, 40 miles radius of the sand pit, and they used to take the sand out there, for the concrete to make the runways. And after the war, of course, that was a great place to play, as you can imagine. But immediately after the war, I suppose, it would have been the Yanks. We call them Yanks. I never remember whether the Yanks of the north or the south of America. I should know, really, but they were always, Americans always term Yanks during the war. I mean, Americans, I say again, they were Yanks. Everybody spoke of them as Yanks. Not in a derogatory way, because... but anyway, what was I going to say about... Oh, come on, you're my prompter.
That the lorries?
Oh, yeah, immediately after the war, that pit, that was a big pit then, water in it, and they use it as a dump, you know. And, you could imagine. But they did say there was loads of sort of live ammo in there, and people, many years after the war, people used to be convinced that that dump, immediately down the bottom of our garden almost, was full of old Jeeps and, American equipment, which wasn't needed after the war, and I always dumped it. But I never saw anything of any value there, particularly. But many people thought there was a lot of gear in there, and even now, well, maybe there is, but... what's that, dearie? Oh, yeah, thanks, yeah. Prompt. What else, Adam? What else?
So I was going to ask, you said you had three elder sisters.
Yeah. My eldest sister, Peg, well, her name was Rose, but I can't remember why she was called Peg. But anyway, Peg. Peg would have been born in about 1920. And she was in the latter part of the war, indeed during the war. She was in the RACS, the woman's army, I think it's termed the RACS, and she was attached to the artillery, and I remember saying that she helped on with the AK-AK guns in Hyde Park in London, yeah. But Peg died.
She was in Belgium.
Don't whisper, dear, speak up.
She was in Belgium too.
Oh yeah, later on, she moved on, and we had some photos at home. She lived with the family in Belgium, I think. When she was billeted with them, I expect. She wasn't on the front or anything, but that was Peg. But she died, can't remember when, or she would know really. But however, Joan, my second oldest sister, was born in 26, and she's still live and kicking big time in Canada, in Prince Edward Island. Right now, I speak with her every month or so on FaceTime. We have a good old chat, and she's really with it, you know. Poor, you can say that. And, oh, that's all right.
She was with the RAF.
Yeah, she was in the RAFs, and she didn't go abroad, but she was, I think she was involved in some sort of radar business or something. I'll ask her again. But when I was telling Joan, my second older sister, who was in Canada, I was going to do this sort of business and involved, you know, she said, oh, she said, you must tell them about the murder in Little Cornard. And I said, no, it can't be the case. And I said, murder, I'd never, well, and that was in 45, where it was either just before the end of the war or just after. This was Joan, just out of the blue, you know. And she said, there was a lady, a woman, named Edna Weimark, who would have been about the same age as my sister Joan, more or less. And she was married to a sailor who was away. Well, Edna, the little tinker, she'd been having an affair with a local bloke. Don't know who, Joan didn't know. But she'd been having an affair, you know, a carry-on, call it what you will. And then, when the sailor, her husband, came home, Edna went back to him. And Joan was relating all this, and I should emphasise, Joan is very much on the ball. And so Edna, who Joan also said, we called her Mousy. Why would you call a girl Mousy? I don't want to know, it doesn't matter. Yeah, how's that? Yeah. Anyway, Edna Weimark went back to the sailor, and the irate guy who'd been having an affair with her, and as Joan termed it, this guy shot Edna through the window. Joan said specifically that he shot this irate local guy who'd been having an affair with Edna, shot Edna through the window. And, you know, I would have thought I would have heard a vague memory of that, you know. And I've asked one or two people, and indeed, you're going to interview Jerv later, apparently, Jerv Jordan, and he lives near where Joan said this woman lived, top of Spout Lane in a little cornard, turn right toward the Jane Bell, you know the Jane Bell. Jane Bell is a pub, not now, but it was. And Edna Weimark lived there on the right, she said, Joan said, distinctly. And I want to find out more about that, but I'm so surprised that I never had a vague memory of it. You know, it would have been a big deal, wouldn't it? Mind you, there have been a lot of people killed in that time, I suppose, anyway, but which is one way of looking at it. But yeah, anyway, go on.
Did your older sister have any involvement in the war in any way as well?
Joan did, I mentioned. I've got four sisters in total, what did I do? And then Daff, my youngest older sister, if that makes sense, because I've got a younger sister. She wasn't in the war, but she went away nursing immediately after the war. Daff was 10 years older than me.
She would have been 98.
She would have been born in, 28. And she went nursing at Hammersmith Hospital in London. But she wasn't directly involved in the war like the other two were, the other two, Joan and Peg. Yes, and she's pretty cute as well, Daff. She's still with us.
How was Joan involved in the war?
Joan?
Yeah.
I don't know as much about that as I should, really. She was, I think I mentioned, she was involved in the raid, because radar was a big deal, of course, at the time. And she was involved in that somehow. She's pretty cucho, and she's pretty, you know, I think she might have been involved in the, not secret or anything, but, I mean, the more complicated part of it. But I really, really should know more. Indeed, I'll find out more about that. I'll speak to her in a couple of weeks' time.
And I remember when we did the pre-interview, you mentioned one of your sisters just had dated an American.
That was Daff, the one that was a nurse, as a matter of fact. Now, I got vague memories of this. The trouble is, you hear these tales so many times, you don't know whether you actually experience it or whether. But I think I have actual vague memories of this. I absolutely had memories of the B-17 thing, and this one as well. Well, Daff, she'd have been, I don't know how old. Anyway, she was going out, sort of going out, with one of the Yanks, the local, a guy who was stationed locally, and he was Goldtooth. Everybody knew him as Goldtooth. You can imagine why. And I think I can, but I say again, because it's been spoken of so much, I can almost see his tooth now. But anyway, he was a very pleasant lad, apparently. And Daff brought him home for supper one night. Mum's invite, I bet. And because Mum, somehow or other, is during the war, or immediately after the war, during the war, probably. Everything was rationed, of course, but Mum rustled up some meat from somewhere, ham or whatever, and got him a ham sandwich or on a plate. Anyway, Goldtooth, the dear boy, he sat there and he's trying to make a good impression of it. Of course he was. And Mum had got some mustard out, Coleman's mustard, the hot mustard. And in those days, it didn't come in jars like it does now, in 25. It came in a powder, and you put the powder in a little pot and mix water with it and stir it up and made the mustard like that. And that used to be bloody hot, I can assure you that. You know, really hot, hotter than the present-day mustard. Well, obviously Mum and Daff wouldn't have known that the American mustard, and I think they called it mustard, but it wasn't mustard, that was more like custard than mustard, I think. It just isn't hot. I think nowadays it's the same, quite probably. But anyway, he thought that was Yankee mustard, if you like. And so he smarmed the English mustard, or the mustard he was served, onto his ham or whatever meat it was. And because he took a bite of it, and the tears come to... I remember Mum used to laugh about it, and Daff, years after the war. I mean, the tears run down his face, you know, because he took this mustard-imbibed sandwich. But Mum always said, and I recall that, you know, how admiring of him she was, because he ate it all, you know. He really did. Yeah, and they used to tell that tale, and that's pretty... I like that story. You know, he really did his part, that guy. I mean, Trump has buggered it up now, but, I mean, he did his part, his thing for America that day. That happened, for sure. Well, so did all the other stuff, but I had vague memories of Goldtooth, because I don't know whether I could actually see his gold tooth now, but that's a funny bit, because he wouldn't have been no age, and yet he had a gold tooth. Must have had some money, mustn't he? Anyway. Yeah, that's Gold Tooth. I wonder where he is now. Well, I reckon I know, but... Yeah, I've been... Well, you talk about that. Controversial, if you like. And it's got nothing to do with... Oh, it has got something to do with the war, because... When I was... That would have been after the war, but there was many Americans over here after the war, because of the war, obviously. And I remember as a young boy walking up Gainsborough Street in Sudbury toward the Market Hill, which was the market in the middle of the town of Sudbury. And in the town of Sudbury, There's pubs, public houses, pubs everywhere. And one of them was the Black Boy. And recently, because of all the stuff that happened, and you mustn't have anything that might be interpreted as being racist or anything, they changed the name of the pub to something.
Lady Elizabeth.
Speak up, darling.
Lady Elizabeth.
Lady Elizabeth. Anyway, I was following, I happened to be walking behind these two young American servicemen, about the same age as our Goldtooth, probably, you know. And it just so happened, and I was just, and they were wandering up. Oh, yeah, black guys, young black guys. And they walked and toward the pub, and as I say, that was the Black Boy, it's called the Black Boy Pub then. Nobody gave it a thought. There's a little black boy on the sign, you know. And I always remember, and another thing I distinctly remember, as opposed to me making up, one of them nudged the other, he looked at the pub and the sign, I suppose, and one of them nudged the other one, and the other looked, and they stood there and they laughed and laughed and laughed. They were tickled pink by this pub called the Black Boy with the little black boy there, you know, like they were, you know. And I thought, you know, what's that all about? I mean, they weren't offended, were they? And why should people be offended nowadays? But that, again, we're talking about the war, and they were here because of the war. What they did on the basis, I don't know. But yeah, that stands out big time. That these two Yanks, young lads, about 20 probably, and they just looked at this thing and they just laughed. Didn't give it another thought, and other than that was amusing, as far as that was concerned.
Do you remember what food was like around during the war or after the war?
The sandwiches, a lot of mustard on, was. I was going to say pretty cool. It wasn't cool at all, was it? Well, you know, it's a big deal again. Of course, the war and rations. We had ration books, and I guess you guys know all about them. But I never ever went hungry. You know, I just did not. I mean, the food pretty basic. And like I say, the stuff was rationed anyway, but my old chap was a bit of a wheeler dealer. My dad was in the First World War, in the trenches. He was wounded twice in the First World War, and both times he was able to go back, whether he wanted to or not, I don't know, but he did. But what? Oh, is that not recalled very well? Okay. Anyway, my dad, because he was in the First World War, he wasn't in the Second, and he was born in 1898. So he would have been 40 or so, when the Second World War broke out. Again, I've lost, what was I going to say about, what was the point of my bringing my old chap up?
Well, because he was a wheeler dealer, he was able to get rabbits and...
Yeah, food, yeah, of course.
He used to have chickens.
Yeah, and he used to get around a bit, you know, a bit of a schemer. And I remember we used to have gallon cans, imperial gallon, not an American gallon, of golden syrup. Do you know what golden syrup? Yeah, I guess you do, because that's still the same now. And where he got it from, I don't know. I don't suppose I want to know, come to that.
And chickens. People had chickens.
Yeah, well, chickens and rabbits. And you know, the old chap didn't go rabbiting or anything. People used to go rabbiting and yeah, surprise.
Bananas.
Yeah, bananas. there's another thing. That was, again, a wartime thing. When we were kids, we'd heard of bananas, but that's all. I suppose we knew what they looked like to a certain extent. Well, we must have done, mustn't we? But bananas are exotic. Well, in a sense, they're hardly exotic now, but they're certainly exotic then. And I remember coming home from school. That would have been after the war, I suppose. But things are very tight and rationed again, of course. one day we were walking back from school across a field that had just been, of corn, had just been cut as it happened. I remember that. Walking toward our home, me and my sister, I'm sure, and several other local lads. And my brother, eldest brother, Jeff, who died in 16. Anyway, then he'd been off school that day for some reason or other. And then we were going back home from school, back home. And Jeff appeared at the other side of the field from home. And he came waving his hands and all excited. And he said, we got some bananas. And we couldn't believe it, you know, bananas. I mean, that wouldn't happen. And I don't think he actually had one on him, you know. But Mum, somehow or other, had got, well, I suppose they just had become available or something. But these things that we'd only dreamt about, that thing there that Asmus is holding, you know, we'd only dreamt about them. And then we were actually going to see one. Like that, yeah. It's just like that, yellow, yeah. But that's the thing, you know, and that stands out, that yeah, things were short and all of a sudden this thing appeared. I don't know, I'm sure they weren't that readily available after then, but Mum had got hold of them somehow. So that was cool. That's a great memory of that.
I was just going to ask, were you aware that you were in the war?
What?
Were you aware that you were alive or there was a war going on around you at the time?
Oh, sorry. Good question, Alan, because, you know, no, of course not, no. It was fun. You know? I mean, this B-17, for instance, I mean, you imagine, what better plaything could you have had? And yet, you know, the idea of them taking off today was to kill 100 people, wasn't it? That was the idea a couple of hours earlier. And that 2 hours later, we were playing in it. And that was the most important thing. The fact that those 100 people were alive at that moment, and, you know, because it had crashed, didn't occur to people. Well, not to kids. Not to kids. No, not in the least. Do you know, I do remember, I used to go to bed, Mum, we were only kids, and we say, I used to say, and she used to tell me, good night everybody in the world except the Germans. I used to say that, and you know how awful that is, isn't it? Because the kids of my age were saying, good night everybody in the world except the English, probably, weren't they? How completely stupid that is. But I wasn't stupid, he wasn't stupid, the guy who said it about the English. But that's stupid anyway, isn't it? But good night everybody. Yeah, I always feel a bit ashamed when I think of that. To say good night everybody in the world except the Germans, but yeah, I hadn't thought of that. I hadn't made a note of that, I think. But if that's the sort of thought you want.
And then, during the war, did you remember any propaganda that was happening at the time?
Or no, Adam.
Were you aware of it being propaganda or anything?
No. Again, you know, I was 4, 5, 6 or something. I mean, you remember the week before last when you were 4, 5 or 6, and, you know, it doesn't mean anything much when you're 4, 5 and 6. Your kid's view, a child's view of 6-year-old kid's view of, is it probably the same, about 12, but you only start thinking about stuff in your late teens, I'm guessing. You know, well, in your late teens, you're a bloody soldier then, aren't you? I was in the army myself at 17. But again, I went in just to learn a trade. I didn't go in to kill people, but no, not when you're 5, 6 or 7. Although I have these memories, they're not the sort of memories that will change the world, I'm afraid. Well, maybe they will. Well, I couldn't do it, but some people might when they think about these people, 100 people are alive now that wouldn't have been if that plane hadn't crashed. So, there you are. Next.
I was wondering, so you did just mention that you signed up to the army afterwards. Did speaking to your dad or anything like that influence your decision? Or
one, I think it's fairly normal, not a bit normal. I never used to talk to my dad about the army. I weren't that close to my dad as it happened, but obviously a lot of people are. No, there was no influence from my father at all. Well, I always knew he was in the First World War and was wounded and all that. No, I simply...
National service.
You had the joint... In the period after the war, up till, I don't know when, I should know, there was national service. So everybody, every bloke, had to serve, unless you were exempt if you were a key worker of some sort. And so you had to do the national service in the Army, Navy or Air Force. You know, I went in the Army and was in the REME, the Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers. And actually, I think that you had to go in when you were 18 for 2 years, 18 to 20. But it sort of varied a bit. And as it happened, and then you could go in for longer if you wanted to. Well, I didn't particularly want to, but I knew I was going to have to do it anyway. And the company I was working for, I only just left school with it, they went bust out of business. And so I figured I might as well volunteer for the Army. This is in 56. Volunteer for the Army. And I had to do 3 years if you volunteered. And so I was still done with 3 years before I was 21 years old anyway. But if you went in, if you volunteered, you could choose your trade. And I was always into nuts and bolts and stuff. And I was in, as I mentioned, the REME, the Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers. And I was a mechanic on army trucks and stuff, you know. But so that was my army thing. I was in Germany all that time, in Hamelin, Pied Piper of Hamelin, type Hamelin. Heard of that? Of course you have, yeah. Never saw him, but saw a few rats, I suppose.
So I guess after the war and sometime after, did you feel a sense of national pride, or was this purely for...
Well, there was then there was a lot of national pride. Anyway, I remember I didn't have a passport, but people did, and you used to read about passports and all that. And I always think I'd like to get a British passport because the British are looked up to worldwide. Not suppose we were then. I don't know about now so much, I'm sure. But no, did I have pride? I suppose I did a bit. I suppose I'm proud of being British in that, but I know you're supposed to say I'm British, you know, the best nation in the world and all that. You know, maybe we are, but there are other nations in the world that would call themselves the top dogs. I mean, I'm not talking about the Trump crap, but I'm talking about... to a certain extent, I was proud. I do remember after the war, when I was very young, immediately after the war, that I was, I suppose I was proud to be British, and we were renowned worldwide, and we're just coming off the, when Britain ruled the world, really, didn't the sun never set on the British Empire and all that, and there were remnants of that even then, you see, when I was in the 40s, say. When I began to think a little bit, and I was sort of coming up, say, 15 or something. But things change all the time, don't they? About all sorts of things change. And, I was proud. Yeah.
I guess the question I'm also very much looking forward to asking as well is about your World War II Jeep.
The World War II Jeep. The Jeep, again, a Jeep, for those who don't know, is a little four-wheel drive American vehicle, open vehicle. The Yanks used them all the time for, I don't know, running around to get the takeaways and stuff. And yeah, I'm sure some people don't know what a Jeep is, I suppose. But anyway, the Jeep, because again, there was so much surplus stuff after the war, worldwide, I suppose. You hear tales of where planes were pushed off aircraft carriers into the Pacific and all that. And there was so much surplus stuff, and there's a lot of American surplus equipment here, some of which, or one of which, was the Jeep, this little thing I mentioned, little four-wheel drive, a very practical little vehicle, you know, in the 40s and 50s, very practical little vehicle. And there were thousands upon thousands of them. About farmers used to have them, and gamekeepers, and goodness, and ordinary people. I mean, I talked to a guy not that long ago, and he was telling me that his father had one as a daily, you know, a daily driver. And of course, many, many, many people did. And they were a hell of a little machine. And so I always remember them and knew of them, and they were an iconic vehicle. I mean, they were an iconic vehicle, sort of thing that looked right. You know, they really did. They were fun as well, you know. And anyway, so I've always thought that'd be nice to get one. And when I sort of began to, you know, get sort of toward retiring age, and I gathered enough bread money to actually buy one, which I did, which was in the state, but because I'm a nuts and bolts person, I did it right up. That I forget how much I gave for it now, but I had to do a lot of work on it and brought it up to a decent standard as it is now. And you know, I'm very proud of it. I brought that when, what, 25 years ago, something like that.
23 years ago.
Yeah, and because they're very expensive now. I mean, you know, we're in 2025. I mean, a good Jeep will cost you $20,000, you know, sterling. You know, and then they were 10 a penny, you know, after the war. But yeah, the Jeep, everybody asked about the Jeep, including young Adam here. I mean, people love the Jeep, you know. But I remember the thing on Sudbury Market Hill. Okay, Dan. On Sudbury Market Hill, an old boy who was old then, my age again, I suppose, when I first had it. And I was saying what fun it was. And they are fun, you know. But he put me in my place, you know. He said, they weren't made for fun. He said, they were made for killing people. And they bloody were. You know, they weren't made for fun. They weren't made for fun for Norman Game to drive about in and everybody ask about it. They were made in the same way as that B-17 was made, drop bombs on people and kill them. And he said, they weren't made for fun, they were made for killing people. And that rather might make you think as well, doesn't it? But I still drive it. And I haven't killed anybody with it yet, thankfully. What do you got here, dear? Yeah, there's a thing, the Jeep. There's a chassis number on them, and from that you can tell when that was built. And my Jeep was built in January, February 1944. And it ended up in France, that's right. So it was built in 44, early part of 44, and that was ended up in France. In actual fact, that was surplus there as it was here, as that sort of stuff would be here. But it was used as a circus, you know, it was part of a circus in France, because some of the wheels were painted all gaudy colours, and there was something on the front, something about a circus on the front. But people used them like that, because they were wheels, you know. And a Jeep dealer guy bought it back here, and I bought it off him. Anyway, I've told people about the Jeep, so I'm talking about it now. And because that was made in early 44 and it ended up in France, I've told the tale so many times that it went over from here on D-Day, you know, June 4. I've told so many people it went over on D-Day, because only because it was here and it ended up in France, And that was made in early 44. And I've told so many people, I believe it myself now, you know. But how it actually got to France, obviously it's something that, undoubtedly it was in the UK and it went over on after D-Day, I don't know, but don't put that down. It went on D-Day, put that down. There's so much gear about, and the bigger trucks, and there's a friend of mine who just died, poor old boy. His father had one of the bigger American trucks, and he used to use it on the farm and carton sugar beet to the sugar beet factory and all that. But there was thousands of them around at the time.
So is it common for American cars to be in the UK?
Not so much cars. No, not cars. Well, there are some, of course, inevitably. But not really. They're called staff cars, but they were military stuff, But no, not in the way you might think.
Mm-hmm. In your childhood, do you remember the planes going overhead? We spoke to Peter, and he told me that you could differentiate if it was a German plane.
Yeah, I can't, to be honest, I can't actually say that I could. But I remember people speaking of that very distinctly, that the drone of the engine or whatever, not was the engine, obviously. You could tell whether that was an American or British, was ours or one of theirs. And I can't remember actually thinking, now, Peter, I'm 87, Peter's 5 years older than me. I mean, that makes a big difference when you're young, and he would have been more aware. I don't know Peter, actually, but he would have been more aware of, well, he'd know more than I would because he's around that much longer. But no, I don't remember any. I certainly remember people speaking of it, but I can't remember saying, oh, that's one of ours or that's one of theirs or anything like that, you know. But I don't know.
Do you remember how they described it?
Pardon?
Do you remember the stories of how they described the difference?
The noise, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, simply, the noise was obviously the engine, wasn't it? And, in the engine on my Morris Minor at home and my Jeep, I can tell a million miles away, if I had that good ears, which engine was running, whether it was the Morris Minor engine. And that undoubtedly was the way you could, people who were around and aware of such things, they could absolutely tell the difference by brrr or brrr sort of thing, That would be that. It had to be, didn't it?
Yeah.
When you think about it.
Everybody did.
Pardon?
Everybody knew the difference.
Yeah, I remember
my mum saying that they used to count the planes out and then count them when they came back. They could tell whether they were British or German.
A lot went on during the war, boy.
I guess just circle back about food. You mentioned that you didn't go hungry or anything. Your dad was quite.
Yeah, a bit of a schemer.
Yeah, he was good with it. But I was wondering if your mum had a staple food, perhaps that you would look forward to, or there was something that she would do on a special occasion, or just the regular.
Summer pudding.
Yeah, but it must have been after the war.
Bread pudding.
Yeah, there was because there was bread available, and when it became not unusual but stale, you wouldn't chuck nowadays. I'm afraid you'd just chuck it in the bin. It's awful, isn't it? But those days you could utilise it. And it's bread and butter pudding, as Anne just mentioned. Bread and butter, and that wouldn't be butter; it'd be fat of some sort. But that was a staple food, I suppose. But the food was, I remember sort of stews and stuff, And like I mentioned, rabbits were available because they were wild and people used to trap them or whatever, They had to play their part as food. That's a hell of a thing, really, when you think about it. Comparing it with now, what the hell is going on now with this, all these years later, and they're still making the balls up, don't they? And yet I did not suffer any hunger pangs at all. You certainly didn't. Well, we didn't. What you didn't have, you didn't miss. No. It's, in a way, you should have suffered more, I suppose. That don't make sense, does it? But yeah, maybe you guys will. I don't know. In some ways, I'm glad I'm 87. But maybe it's a bit pessimistic.